Fire Drill Podcast is starting. Gwen and Jay here to get this party going.
We have early retiree FI fighter here to talk to us about real estate, active investing in a community where passive investing rules the roost, and what he's been up to since he retired. Let's kick it off.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your hosts, Gwen from Fiery Millennials and Jay from Millennial Boss.
Hey, everybody. We have Jay from FIFighter.com in the house tonight, and he is our first actually retired guest on the show. Welcome, Jay.
Thank you so much for having me here. I got to say that that's pretty exciting stuff, so I hope I don't disappoint here.
You will not. And I have my wonderful co-host, Gwen, here as well.
Hey, everyone.
Gwen, I promise I will introduce you like I'm supposed to next time.
You know, I kind of like it where you're like focus on the new person and then you're like, oh, and don't forget my awesome co-host.
Don't forget Gwen. She's in the corner somewhere or something. awesome. So, Jay, how long have you been retired?
I officially walked away from my engineering career a little over a year ago. So I think it was in June. No, sorry, it was March of 2016. So a little over a year. And I just got to say time flies when you're having fun.
Yeah, for sure. So we wouldn't be financial independence podcasters without asking you, what age were you when you walked away from your job?
Let's see, I was 31, but I first hatched, I guess, this idea and this plan in the end of 2011. So I started the blog in 2012. I think I was 27 when the blog started, and then I walked away at 31.
Okay, so you had 4 years of planning. How did you tie everything together so neatly and just be like, well, I'm done now?
So I would actually attribute most of my, I guess you would say, early FI progress success to real estate. Again, that was being in the right place at the right time. I'm based in the Bay Area, and that was a huge tailwind because for anyone who's, you know, familiar with the coast, I guess, for the most part, if you're talking about areas like San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, New York City, Boston, like the coastal regions have just experienced the most massive form of appreciation. I mean, not only just property values, but in terms of rent appreciation, which gives you the cash flow. And for a lot of people on the path to early FI, that's what you're really focused on is the cash flow or passive income. So, you know, to get that type of tailwind, it just does wonders for the progress.
So one thing I really like about your blog and also your story is that you have a different perspective on how to get to FI than maybe some of the other bloggers out there. And one particular thing I can think of is picking individual stocks. We hear a lot about VTSAX and the S&P 500 index. What makes you decide that individual stocks were for you?
But in terms of individual stocks, when I was actually on the early FI path in 2011, I was, for the most part, buying those index funds. I actually had an employer where the company plan was sponsored by Vanguard. So everybody, like you mentioned, the kind of the VFINX, the total market index, those are the most popular funds. Again, that's also a consequence of being at the right place at the right time, because I guess contrary to popular belief, and we tend to forget this over time, is whether it's stocks or real estate, these investment vehicles are cyclical. So markets go up and they go down. When you're spoiled and you've had nothing but up, you know, in the last, like, let's say 8 or 9 years, basically, I guess, since the financial crisis, right? I mean, that's closing in on 10 years. So you kind of forget these things. But, you know, even with things like index investing, I think they are efficient and they work up to a certain point in time. But when you get to a point in time, when based on historical valuations, things no longer look cheap. A lot of people like to use, you know, like the Case-Shiller PE ratio, or Warren Buffett has his own earnings to gross domestic product or something like that. There's something called a Buffett indicator. So whatever metric you want to use, it's always the most, you know, beneficial as an investor if you can get in when those valuations are near historic lows. So when I switched to individual stocks, that was more to play mining stocks. That's kind of what I've been dabbling in since 2015. And that's a whole nother topic. If you guys want to go into those details, we can. But I basically went after a sector that I feel is probably the most undervalued. If it's not that, it's one of the most undervalued sectors in the entire investing space right now.
So in terms of your total allocation, are you still invested in index funds, or have you put yourself into individual funds at this point?
Yeah, so my approach is I'm pretty active as a manager, so I don't really set it on autopilot. It's not really a buy and hold forever type of scheme. So I'd say 50% of my allocation is in real estate. So with those assets, I do treat it like I would an index fund, where, you know, it's the more conventional classical approach. You buy and hold it, you collect the cash flow or dividends, and you just leave it on autopilot. Rain or shine, you're going to collect the paycheck. So it's all good. But I would say the other 50% of my portfolio is actively managed for the mining stocks, because the sector is just too volatile as a whole. And the valuations tend to swing like very violently. So if you're not on top of things, it's easy to, kind of step on landmines. So, you know, there's no guarantees in this space. You really have to take a baseball approach. And that's kind of how I try to describe it on the blog, where, for example, if anyone follows baseball, one of the greatest hitters of all time is Ted Williams. He played for the Red Sox. He's in the Hall of Fame. And, you know, one year he batted 400, and that was like a historical season that basically nobody has been able to replicate ever since. And when you say bat 400, that just means you got four base hits and you were out six times out of 10, you were out. So you're out more times than you're on base. But in baseball, that's considered legendary. You know, you're like the best of the best. So, you know, that's something that's hard for the human psyche to kind of, you know, work out in their head, because they're always thinking, you know, if I invest in something and the asset or the investment blows up in my face, that kind of scars me and I never want to touch that space again. But to play mining, because it's so volatile, your mindset really has to be, you know, if I buy a basket of 10 stocks, I should probably expect maybe five or six of them to blow up in my face and go to zero. And the mindset is really the gains that you can make with your winners are so great. Not only do they amortize your losers completely, but the rate of return that you get is still, it justifies the endeavor in the first place.
Hmm. Do you ever touch tech stocks at all?
You know, in the market cycle, we've had an expansion cycle for basically the last 10 years. So a lot of these valuations have gotten really stretched. So for a lot of these companies, I don't see the upside where they can really grow the business to justify the risk you take, because I look at it, the downside risks are being far greater than any remaining upside. There's not that much juice left to squeeze. And for the most part, I like to focus on assets and investments where I feel like the upside potential is really massive. And one philosophy I kind of worked in my head, I don't think it applies to everybody, but I said something along the lines of, I would rather risk 50% of my capital or investment principal in hopes of making a 500% gain, if that seems conceivable and realistic, as opposed to risking, let's say, 20 or 30%, but I don't have upside much more than exactly that 20 or 30%. It's like if you're taking the same amount of risk as the reward side of the equation, then for me, it has no appeal. So what I've kind of try to do in the last few years is work around different asset classes. And this is something I kind of picked up from Stanley Druckenmiller, where he basically said, he doesn't mind going all in and putting all his eggs in one basket. But if he does that, he tries to watch that one basket very, very carefully. So when I heard that kind of saying, it made me think a little bit. And then I kind of rationalized that it kind of made sense with what I wanted to do.
Right. That's why I'm so glad that we have you on the podcast today, because it's important to have diverse perspectives on things. And sometimes I know the financial independence subreddit can get a little bit herd of sheep, like everyone's doing the same thing. So it's
lemmings.
Yeah, lemmings. I mean, I'm one of them myself. So it's really nice to have a different perspective. And I think what you said earlier about your real estate, that is different as well. So appreciation has been huge for you, and you've invested in one of the most expensive markets in the country. And whereas a lot of people right now are really interested in getting these smaller rentals, maybe in the Midwest or the South or less expensive places. So why was that your strategy?
Yes, and that's actually a very interesting topic as well, if you want to dive into it, because I do have properties in the Midwest. So I actually did a recent post and video on the blog. It was called My Most Important Post Ever, and I used that title to hopefully get some more traffic there, because I think it's a really important. Basically, I went over my biggest learnings, what I felt were the biggest reasons for my success, and what I did right and what I did wrong. So I just try to, you know, be really forthcoming and transparent with, you know, my results. I put that out there. But the thing about appreciation is, you know, I found from my experience as a real estate investor, I used to hang out a lot on the Bigger Pockets forums, that the biggest critics and cynics and, you know, the people who scoff at property value appreciation the most are usually, it comes from the people who have never experienced it for themselves. And that really took me aback when I actually was able to kind of connect those dots. Because then I started talking to these really successful guys who made all this appreciation. And I would used to ask them during meetups, you know, can I pick your brain? Like, why is it that you're not buying these, you know, cheaper rentals that don't necessarily have appreciation potential, but they cash flow so well? And, you know, I guess you have to be careful with these things because some people are very condescending and investing can get really personal because we have so much at stake with it. So it's just one of those things that it does crazy things to people's emotions. So, you know, you try to work out that part of it and just try to get the, you know, the crux of what they're saying. But when I talked to enough people, it was basically trying to connect the dots and trying to be as unbiased as I could. I could kind of see that the most successful investors that were associated with these meetups, for the most part, they were the ones who struck it rich by massive appreciation. You know, a lot of them were Silicon Valley guys, got really lucky, just, you know, by chance, by luck, they just happened to buy a primary residence, you know, in this farmland that eventually became Silicon Valley. And nobody had that kind of foresight, you know, back in like the 60s and 70s and 80s. So, you know, just by luck, but then they kind of taught me from their experiences. If you ride one appreciation cycle wave, you can make like enough gains for a lifetime. Like you can make $1 million in one cycle. That's not far-fetched. That's not unrealistic. People get spoiled by it, but the reality is, and this kind of was reinforced to me when I lived in Hong Kong for basically the last year. And I saw people fighting like, you know, just to the bone and just like trampling over each other for a shot to win, let's say a 400 square feet, you know, one bedroom or studio apartment in Hong Kong. And then it just really makes you think like, wow, if you have prime real estate that's in the best jurisdictions, you know, best locations that people want to live in, highly desired units, you can fail. Yes, you can fail in anything, especially with investing, but your odds of failure are so low because even if you get frustrated and you want out, the moment, you know, you put your house on listing, you're going to have like 100 offers that night. And that just really hammered home the importance of location for me. And, you know, that's unfortunately what you don't get when you go to a lot of these turnkey pockets out in the Midwest. And, you know, they try to get the more affluent investors out in the coast, like California or New York City or something, like to go invest there. But I learned, you know, that's kind of, I call it the grind it out approach, where it's slow and steady. You'll never get the appreciation. And if you have one major hiccup along the way, let's say you have to replace the roof or, you know, like your pipes, then one major expense can derail an entire year of cash flow. So your margin for error is razor thin. So that's why I'm a strong advocate of avoiding the turnkey pockets that don't have appreciation potential. Like if I was to go to the Midwest, I'm not saying the whole market's bad, but I would focus in the best spots where you can get the 10 out of 10 schools in the best school districts, where you always want to invest where homeowners want to live when it comes to real estate. That's one of the best and smartest things you can do to de-risk yourself if you're going to play the real estate game.
Just so you know, I own property in the Midwest.
I did not know that.
So thanks for coming on to the show, and we're never going to publish this. No, I'm just kidding.
But you said, Jay, you have properties in the Midwest, though.
I do, yes.
So how many properties do you have in total?
I have 3 out in the Midwest right now.
And in your whole portfolio?
Let's see. So I have 3 in California, so you could say 6.
So why aren't you tempted to sell the California properties?
Those are my golden hens. I don't plan on ever selling them because it's not so much just getting to early FI. The other part of the equation, and I kind of learned this over the last year, I kind of had an epiphany, is you want to maintain early FI for perpetuity, you know, forever and ever. And I look at these golden hens, they only get better with time. So I can't foresee myself ever selling them. They get the best tenants, the best appreciation, the best rent appreciation. It's a very viable exit strategy. If I wanted to sell tomorrow, I could easily find a buyer. And you know, similarly, if I put an ad on Craigslist, you could have, like my friend just did it with his primary because he wants to move out of the country. And he had basically 10 offers the night he posted the listing. And when you go to less desirable areas, that's just the reality is it's never going to be that seamless or painless. So it's a lot, again, it's a lot more work. I'm not saying it can't work. It can definitely work. It's just, it's more grinded out kind of approach where you have to get into the nitty gritty details. And, you know, in California, again, we've all been spoiled. When you have appreciation in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, most people have doubled the property value of their home since they bought, if they bought during post-crisis, and the rents have all gone up by, you know, $600 or $1,000 a month. I mean, you give yourself a lot of headroom for errors. So even if landlording is not your cup of tea, the margins are so large that, again, it's tough to screw that up.
The market is so nuts down there. When I lived down there, one of my favorite things to do on weekends is to go to open houses, because those things are crazy. The houses are they're really nice. They cost millions of dollars, which is nuts. And you can go in your flip-flops and a hoodie, and they don't know if you're a tech millionaire or you're broke. Like, you have no idea. And they're catered. So they have Ben & Jerry's, a latte bar. It's what? Honestly nuts. It's a great little Sunday, I'll tell you.
Wow. That's really... That's night and day, Julie. When I first started doing this in 2012, I was actually getting in right when the turn was happening and all the interest was coming back. But I remember my brother bought his first property in April 2012. We went to the open house. There was the listing agent and nobody else. And he didn't even pay. He didn't overpay. I think he either paid at market or he even went below market. And he got the place fixed up and it was turnkey ready. And basically he had all the power. So it was still a buyer's market at that time. But by the summer of 2012, it just started to turn. And what you're describing now, I mean, it's so surreal. I can't even really fathom that.
Yeah, it was super competitive. I just remember overhearing like, oh, we already have 5 offers, and people getting all nervous and flurrying around. But it was fun.
I just imagine you like chill and be like, yo, what's up, guys? I'm just here for some ice cream. Yeah, this is a nice place.
I'm like, looks good.
Good luck.
Where's the ice? What do you guys have today? Oh, that's great.
I'm sure they don't even mind because they can easily swing that. I mean,
yeah, exactly. And I'm sure the more people that come makes the people who are actually putting in offers more stressed out and maybe like put in higher offers. So they're like, come on in.
Yeah, this is an important point I want to add here. And it's what you guys said earlier about, you know, herd mentality. It's easy to chase at the market top because it feels like the right thing to do. And there's nobody who is going to give you any flack, and you're never going to get any criticism, because in a market environment where nobody's losing money and hasn't lost money in the last 5 years, 10 years, nobody basically remembers, because everybody has short term memory. And, you know, you won't get these alarm bells that will ever go off for you. But if you contrast that to a time, even 2012, when you're trying to actively hunt for a property and all your friends, because I experienced this with my coworkers, they were all telling me it's a really bad time to buy. And I was crunching numbers and I would show them like spreadsheets. I'd say, but I'm getting like $600 a month in cash flow. They're like, yeah, that's still a bad deal. Like, I wouldn't do it because it's just so risky. Prices are going to keep going down. Because in that environment, when there's foreclosures that are prevalent and you have short sales left and right, and, you know, everything is about, you know, the banks are just flooded with all this excess inventory, then it's just that's just the environment that you're operating in, where it's just all negativity. So nobody's going to kind of tell you and kind of harp on you to get moving, because it's a buying opportunity of a lifetime. So this is just something that investors, especially anybody who wants to get to early FI, you have to keep this in mind, just how sentiment changes from a market top to a market bottom. It's absolutely night and day, and you have to pay attention to these things. Otherwise, you know, I had friends that thought about buying rental property back in the depths of, I call it the depths of despair. That's basically a market bottom. And they were talked out of it, and they were straddling the sidelines for the longest time, couldn't make a move. And then finally prices shot up. And then, you know, again, they didn't want to make a move. They didn't want to chase. And then finally, fast forward to now, and they ended up not buying anything. So, you know, you have to be able to think for yourself and kind of detach yourself from the consensus view, is, I guess, the point I'm trying to make.
Yeah, for sure. I was just thinking back to where I was in 2012, and a lot of the girls that I worked with were buying properties as solo females. And at the time, I remember like being a little bit nervous about it. And they were like, yeah, you should totally do this. You should buy it. But I didn't pull the trigger. And if I did, some of those properties, they really would have went up. But Gwen, that's why I think it's so badass that you just went and you're like, I'm buying this triplex by myself. Hello. And just jump right in it.
Yep. And I actually tried to buy a property in my last city as well, but that deal fell through due to some wonky zoning issues. But yeah, I mean, it's the numbers Made sense. And I was tired of sitting on the sidelines. You know, it was like now or never, right? Might as well get started today.
So, Jay, if you are someone who you're not as far along in the FI path, you're just starting out or you're a couple years in, would you say this is not the right time to jump into real estate in some of these markets?
You know, it's really tough to, paint like or put a blanket statement on things, because the reality is nobody has a crystal ball. And even, you know, I guess even 2 years ago, I thought we were near a market top. So I was basically calling the top in the market in summer 2015. That's when I went really crazy. I sold all my index funds and everything, because I thought we were due for a correction, and I was totally wrong. So the market's probably up 20% or more since the time that I sold out. So, yeah, so these things are really tough to say. Nobody knows how far this can go. I can only speak for myself, but if I was starting out today, I definitely wouldn't be looking at real estate. And you know, this is something else that's important. If you're an investor and you're on early FI, and even if you own a whole portfolio, like I own a lot of real estate, right? I have no problem bashing my real estate. I'll do that all day long. And that's something I see. One of the mistakes that investors make is they get too passionate for whatever investment vehicle that they just so happen to be utilizing. Because I know friends who are in real estate and they swear allegiance to real estate. They won't touch any other asset class. And, you know, I think that can be kind of dangerous in that sense, where you're kind of blinded by certain realities because you refuse to look at them. So for me, like, I have no problem and I don't take it personally. If somebody wants to rip apart my real estate portfolio and say these assets are way overpriced and they need to fall by 50% or something, I would just accept it and be like, yeah, I would agree that it's pretty overpriced right now. You can't generate yield for sure. If you were to use a conventional down payment, let's say in the Bay Area, you're not going to get cash flow. It's going to be negative. So most people that to justify the purchase, they're putting in like 50% down payments, or, you know, they're really paying up just to get the yield. Either that, or actually, it's really sad. I sold a partnership deal to these other investors in California, and they basically rationalized it and said, I will take negative $300 a month in negative cash flow because I'm sure the appreciation will bail me out 5-10 years down the line. Again, that's open for debate on what's the right thing to do. I mean, these guys obviously rationalized it in their minds that it was acceptable. But let's just say me and my partners were very glad, you know, to just offload that deal to them. We said, if you want negative $300 a month in cash flow, take it. You know, like, we'll pocket the gains. We're cool with that. So
are you still actively trying to acquire properties now that you are FI?
To be honest, I have zero interest in rental properties because I'm very picky and selective with my rentals. I was totally spoiled back in 2012. So I set the bar, that is the bar. So that's kind of where things are. And, you know, maybe I'll lower it a little bit, but if I can't get good returns, whether cash flow, and I certainly don't think the appreciation potential is there anymore in most markets, especially if you're talking about the Bay Area, California. And, you know, I was in Hong Kong and I was just absolutely mortified with how pricing has escalated out there. And, you know, I'm pretty sure any first world city like Sydney, London, Vancouver, Toronto, you know, just all these places have all just skyrocketed. They're not affordable at all. So in that sense, I just can't see myself getting back into that space. And, you know, in contrast, again, I mean, I'm not trying to talk up mining too much, but that sector has been absolutely annihilated. It's at record lows, basically. There's so much more appeal for me to go bargain hunting in a sector that everybody hates and nobody can imagine rising again. So, you know, I have a lot of fun buying low and trying to sell high later. So that's the approach that's worked for me up to now. And that's the approach that I want to continue to utilize. I would like to believe that I'm an agnostic investor, where I don't really discriminate across asset classes. You just have to get me in the right vehicle that's the best bang for your buck at the moment. And, you know, I'll try to get educated in that space. And then if it makes sense to me, then I have no qualms with just going big or just investing heavily into that sector instead.
Got it. So what types of things have you done now that you are retired early that you wouldn't have been able to do before?
Okay, the fun stuff now.
Yeah, let's get into the fun stuff.
All right. Well, I've heard people say this when I was like way back when I first started the blog, and I used to think like, man, it would be so great if get rid of my alarm clock and never have to use that thing again. That was always one of my dreams. And, you know, I don't remember I think the only time I used an alarm clock the last year was I had to drive like my brother to the airport or something like that. It was like a really early flight. And I remember I was like getting in the car at, I don't know, 5 or 6 a.m. and thinking like, man, this really, really sucks. Like, I hate this feeling. And I just completely had detached myself from it. So it was one of those things that I would say is a huge blessing, just being able to sleep whenever you want. And for the most part, wake up, you know, in the morning without really being like pressed for time. Like sometimes, you know, if you want to like lay in bed and get another hour of rest or something, you can do that. But, you know, if it's a nice day, you want to get up early and take a jog. And I used to love doing that in Hong Kong because I live right by the coast. So, you know, if you got up like 6 a.m. before the sun rose, it is just like a spectacular view, fresh morning air. It's just like this really great feeling. And, you know, there were other people doing that too, but you can kind of see them rushing through their routine because they had to get to the office probably, you know, like 8 or 9 or something. And I would just like, you know, take my sweet time and then just, you know, see what the fishermen were up to and see if they caught anything. And, you know, just, I don't know that, you know, there's a lot of little shops nearby and just waiting for those to open up. And then, you know, just life unscripted is how I would best describe it.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, that sounds pretty awesome. So you worked in tech companies, and do you miss that at all? Do you miss the challenge of
that's a great question. And that's something that I think is worth addressing post FI. To be honest, I do miss that. I do miss a lot of the challenges because when you're in tech, for sure, especially if it's like a really innovative company that's trying to pioneer, you know, groundbreaking new things. So when you eliminate that from the equation, and that's the one thing about early FI is you don't really have that time pressure, then a lot of it, you know, is on you to be as productive as you want to be. You know, like sometimes I'll write a post and I'll get halfway done and, you know, I might take a break and I'll say, I'll get back to this, before the end of the night. And then I end up not doing it. And then I put it off for another week or two. And then I'm just, you know, in a way I'm kicking myself. I'm kind of frustrated. I'm like, why did I do that? Why am I slacking so much? And there's nobody to hold me accountable. So that's the one thing that kind of I'm struggling with. I'll admit it's not that easy.
Yeah, I can definitely relate to that. I know that's something that I'm worried about a little bit when I do eventually retire early, because you can scale when you're at a big company. It's difficult when it's just you.
You know, honestly, I can't say that I'm going to have that problem because I have like 8 million and 5 things that I want to do. And there's just not enough time in the world to do it all. And I'm just going to be like trying to get everything done that I want to get done.
Yeah, I definitely can see that too.
Yeah, and that's one of the benefits. So, you know, there's pros and cons. But, you know, I could say like if you have like for me, if I have that feeling of missing that certain aspect of work, I mean, that's more than offset by, let's say I get to go to a coffee meetup with, you know, readers and other people, like-minded individuals, like every day of the week. Like that will far outweigh, you know, anything that I missed out of in high tech. So I'm not saying it's not worth it. But it's one of those things where sometimes, like, don't you all feel like you wish there was more than one of you, like you could duplicate yourself and do all these different things?
Yes.
And have
every
all
day.
Yeah. All these avenues for fulfillment. So it's just when I'm forced to analyze, I guess, that tech side, I could see some of the good things about it. But like Gwen said, like once you have a million other things to do and you're embracing those things and you're having the time of your life, you quickly forget, like, you know, all the things that you liked or missed about high tech. So it's not like I wake up every day and I regret walking away from that. So it's not that at all.
Right. Yeah. I was just thinking of Hermione Granger when Dumbledore gave her that special time travel thing.
Time Turner.
That needs to exist. Time Turner. Yeah.
It totally needs to exist.
So let's see. If you were to describe your blog to folks, what would you say?
I'd say it's one person's journey to early FI and how they did it and their rationale behind it, like the whole thought process along the way. Somebody starting out today or who's new to the blog, they can go back, you know, in time, everything's all time capsuled and you can go through the entire history. Like if somebody's wondering like, oh, how did you get to 1 million? They can start like when it was, I don't even remember, like, let's say I started at 300,000 or something like that. And you can track all the progress along the way. So that's the one thing I've tried to pride myself in the blog on, is to be transparent. And for anybody who's just picking it up, they can pick up basically anywhere.
Over at fifighter.com.
Yes.
All right. So we usually wrap up this podcast with one last question. Are you ready?
Fire away.
All right. If you could do anything in the world, have anything you wanted, what would be your wildest dream?
My wildest dream.
Go crazy.
Oh man, this is not going to be unfortunately not going to be really crazy. But the first thought I had is actually when I was in Vietnam, and I was walking down Benton Street in Ho Chi Minh City, and it was a striking revelation for me and a shock. Basically, the disparity in the world between the have and the have-nots, and you know, to see so many poor people on the streets, and you know, out there they're not allowed to ask for money, so what they try to do is they try to get foreigners and tourists to buy lottery tickets. So that's kind of the cover up, because I think the government cracked down on people that were they used to be beggars. And to see like the tears in these people's eyes, you know, a lot of them were holding like infants or babies, and they're just trying to make ends meet, right? And I think the early FI journey, as great as it is, it's such an individual journey and experience. Like, you always have to step back and kind of realize that you're really just a small, you know, minute little thing in the grander scheme of things. The world is so big and there's so much going on. So just those moments, like when I was there and it really hit me, it just made me realize, like, as great as all this is, when you're finally free from, like, let's say the rat race and the matrix and all that, there's gotta be something you can do that you can give back and, you know, better and help other people around you. There's definitely different outlets. I mean, I'm not saying you have to go out and just, you know, buy lottery tickets, but whether it's like, you know, blogging or doing even podcasts like this, just an outlet to help people and to expand, I guess, that reach. Like, you know, when you're working and you don't have all the time in the world, your bandwidth is pretty limited. You can't do that much. I can obviously do a lot more right now. But in the future, hopefully I get the opportunity to kind of grow that platform and just help more people. Because I think that's one thing I've realize, especially this year with a lot of stuff that's been going on in my life, like the importance of time for one, and just being able to give back to and help other people.
That's awesome.
Yeah. That's a pretty boring answer.
No, that's a really good answer. So Jay, thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun, and it actually went by really, really fast. but I'm so glad that you guys had me on, and hope we can do it again in the future.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.
If you like us, leave us a review on iTunes. If you're like me, you have no idea how to do that. So in the podcast app or in iTunes, search for Fire Drill Podcast, find it, click the reviews tab, and write something to make my mother proud of me. We read every single review and want to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making this podcast possible.